From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
The world's finance ministers are set to meet in Shanghai as preparations began Thursday for the coming G20's International Finance Group. China's economic situation is expected to be one of the big items on the agenda, as CCTV's Xi Wenjing reported from Shanghai early Thursday.
We know that the world economy has an unpleasant start in 2016. Global stocks are slumping, oil prices hit a 10-year low, and the values in currencies in emerging markets have been very volatile. The IFF conference offered a good forum for business leaders and officials to discuss and share perspectives on topics under G20 agenda. For example, in today's morning session, Mr. Zhu Guangyao, Vice Minister of Chinese Ministry of Finance, emphasized that the fiscal policy will play a bigger role in China's economy in the future, and also he stressed on coordination. He also mentioned that the current tension in China's economy is caused by China's internal economic challenge, which is structural adjustment, and he's sure that this transition will enable China's economy move toward a sustainable growth, and this will surely benefit the world economy. And many other important figures will show up. For example, Mr. Zhou Xiaochuan, governor from People's Bank of China, will make a speech tomorrow. We know that the fluctuation of Chinese stock market and the depreciation of yuan has been among favorite topics among global media. But in his most recent talk, he said that he saw no basis for further depreciation of RMB. And also we'll hear talks from Christine Lagarde, Managing Director from International Monetary Fund, and she's calling for the financial chiefs meeting in Shanghai to focus on global economic spillovers, and also calling for a better coordination in fiscal policies and structural reform.
Global economic forecasts from groups including the IMF and the OSCE are down for the coming year, and there's been a reversal of the decades-long trend of investment in the developing world's economies.
What the global economy is facing now is sluggish demand, weak investment, and high risk in financial instability, and among which the high risk in financial instability is essential. Economists, they are calling for a strong collective response to fighting the sagging global growth. And we know that growth in developing economies has reached the slowest pace since the global financial crisis in 2008, and the trend of global growth has shifted towards the developed economies. And we know that the emerging markets has always been the best hope of the global economy. But in 2015, nearly $1 trillion investment capital has been flooded from emerging markets. It's the first net outflow in 27 years. We know that G20 member countries, they represent over 85% of the global GDP and over 75% of global trade, and covers two-thirds of the world's population. So people, they are hoping that this financial chiefs meeting in China, amid such a gloomy world economic picture in general, those policymakers could steer the global economy towards certainty and stability if they can agree together and to take some politically difficult steps.
People in Libya's eastern city of Benghazi took to the streets, celebrating after parts of the city were cleansed of militia groups and Daesh terrorists after 2 years of deadly fighting. Forces loyal to one of the fractured country's two governments, the one based in Tripoli, took control of a district in Benghazi which had been a stronghold for militant groups late Tuesday. But the fighting continued in Daesh-controlled pockets in southern and western areas of Benghazi. Earlier, ISIL militias briefly entered the western city of Sabratha, beheading 11 members of security forces there. On Wednesday, the UN heard a report that, 5 years after the U.S.-NATO intervention, Libya has been plagued by widespread human rights violations amounting to war crimes and a dramatically worsening situation for the people there in general. Announcing the findings of a new report into abuses in the war-torn country, the UN Human Rights Office, or OHCHR, highlighted that all warring parties were responsible. Among its recommendations, the report calls for the International Criminal Court to be given more resources to investigate and prosecute those responsible for atrocities in the North African state. OHCHR's Gurdip Sangha, speaking with UN Radio's Daniel Johnson, described what investigators found.
I think this report really illustrates the magnitude and the widespread nature of the violations and abuses taking place in Libya. The report covers the period from 2014, and it really reflects upon an increase in violence since then and a worsening human rights situation since then as well. And it really documents the accounts of some of those who are bearing the brunt of this, including migrants, women, internally displaced persons, children.
Give us a bit more detail on the kind of abuses that are being delivered on children, for example. I think you talk about sexual abuse on children as young as 11.
You're right. The report reflects upon the violations which have been perpetrated against children, including sexual abuse. And it also refers to and addresses the recruitment of children and the use of children in hostilities by groups pledging allegiance to ISIL.
And talking of ISIL, it's not just the extremist groups who are accountable and responsible for these abuses, it's all sides to the conflict.
The report details violations and abuses by all parties, both state and non-state actors. And indeed, it goes into quite some detail as to the situation of the justice system, which indeed is in a state of collapse in many parts of the country as a result of prosecutors and judges being killed, abducted, threatened. As an illustration, to our knowledge, there's not been a single prosecution of an armed group leader or very limited investigations. So that really illustrates the situation and the fact that the justice system does not have the capacity to investigate or prosecute the sheer magnitude of violations and abuses taking place.
Could you perhaps give us a detail on the kind of scale of this investigation, how many people you spoke to, and what you hope will happen? Because you have identified war crimes, but crimes against humanity will take a much bigger burden of proof.
The team itself consisted of about 6 human rights officers, and they were supported by security administration and translation staff. Indeed, the team spoke to about 200 victims and witnesses and another 50 interlocutors. In terms of what the report and what the office is recommending, it's recommending a number of recommendations which fundamentally refer to ensuring accountability and the re-establishment of the justice sector within Libya, including for the international community to support the International Criminal Court to investigate alleged crimes under international law.
So it's basically a case of watch this space while the abuses continue in Libya.
Well, that's why the report is urging action as soon as possible, both in relation to supporting the ICC and in relation to ensuring that the re-establishment of the justice sector is a priority for any future assistance or in terms of any future action by a new government.
Friday marks 5 years to the day since the English language newspaper Pakistan Observer first reported that US, UK and French troops had landed in Benghazi, Libya, via ships of India's Navy over the 2 days prior. A report that signaled the beginning of the end for the Libyan Jamahiriya. That report of the landing of those troops came a day before the first of 2 UN Security Council resolutions addressing unrest in Libya, and nearly 3 weeks before the Security Council authorized the no-fly zone that was used by the U.S. as cover for its 8-month-long daily bombardment of the North African country. Shortly after the Council approved the no-fly zone, then-Secretary of State Hillary Clinton address the media.
Good evening. I'm just returning from the White House, where I met with the President and the National Security Team, and I want to give you an update on the international community's efforts to implement UN Security Council Resolutions 1970 and 1973 and protect the civilians of Libya. Events have moved very quickly, so let's be clear about where we stand and how we got here. When the Libyan people sought to realize their democratic aspirations, they were met by extreme violence from their own government. The Libyan people appealed to the world to help stop the brutal attacks on them, and the world listened. The Arab League called for urgent action. In response, the UN Security Council mandated all necessary measures to protect civilians, including a no-fly zone. But the regime's forces continued their assaults, and last weekend they reached Benghazi itself. We faced the prospect of an imminent humanitarian disaster. Hundreds of thousands of civilians were in danger. So an international coalition was compelled to act. French planes were the first to reach the skies over Benghazi. Cruise missiles from the United States and the United Kingdom followed, striking the regime's air defenses and clearing the way for Allied aircraft to implement the no-fly zone. Many other nations have now joined this effort. After only 5 days, we have made significant progress. A massacre in Benghazi was prevented. Gaddafi's air force and air defenses have been rendered largely ineffective, and the coalition is in control of the skies above Libya. Humanitarian relief is beginning to reach the people who need it. For example, just today, we learned that at least 18 doctors and nurses from an organization funded by the United States Agency for International Development had arrived in Benghazi and were beginning to provide support to the city's main hospital. Gaddafi's troops have been pushed back, but they remain a serious threat to the safety of the people. From the start, President Obama has stressed that the role of the U.S. military would be limited in time and scope. Our mission has been to use America's unique capabilities to create the conditions for the no-fly zone and to assist in meeting urgent humanitarian needs. And as expected, we're already seeing a significant reduction in the number of U.S. planes involved in operations as the number of planes from other countries increase in numbers. Today, we are taking the next step. We have agreed, along with our NATO allies, to transition command and control for the no-fly zone over Libya to NATO. All 28 allies have also now authorized military authorities to develop an operations plan for NATO to take on the broader civilian protection mission under Resolution 1973. NATO is well suited to coordinating this international effort and ensuring that all participating nations are working effectively together toward our shared goals. This coalition includes countries beyond NATO, including Arab partners, and we expect all of them to be providing important political guidance going forward. We have always said that Arab leadership and participation is crucial. The Arab League showed that leadership with its pivotal statement on Libya. They joined the discussions in Paris last weekend on implementation. And we are deeply appreciative of their continuing contributions, including aircrafts and pilots from Qatar. This evening, the United Arab Emirates announced they are joining the coalition and sending planes to help protect Libyan civilians and enforce the no-fly zone. We welcome this important step. It underscores both the breadth of this international coalition and the depth of concern in the region for the plight of the Libyan people. In the days ahead, as NATO assumes command and control responsibilities, the welfare of those civilians will be of paramount concern. This operation has already saved many lives, but the danger is far from over. As long as the Gaddafi regime threatens its people and defies the United Nations, we must remain vigilant and focused. To continue coordinating with our partners and charting the way forward, I will travel to London to attend an international conference on Tuesday convened by the United Kingdom. Our military will continue to provide support to our efforts to make sure that Security Council resolutions 1970 and 1973 will be enforced. This is an important effort that has garnered the support and the active participation of nations who recognize the significance of coming together in the international community through the United Nations to set forth a clear statement of action to be taken in order to protect innocent civilians from their own government. It is an effort that we believe is very important, and we'll look forward to coordinating closely with all those nations that are participating. Thank you very much.
Days after Clinton's address, RT's Kevin Owen spoke with political analyst Webster Tarpley, one of many American analysts who predicted that what has happened in Libya would happen if the U.S. intervened.
Echoes, do you think, Hello. Of the past here, Webster? The U.S. has tried this before, hasn't it? Supplying weapons to rebels in Afghanistan back in the 80s. That didn't turn out so well. Those weapons, indeed, that expertise being used against them now. Do you think we could see a repeat in Libya?
I'm very much afraid that it is. We have a study from West Point, the United States Military Academy, dated December 2007, which would indicate that the band of territory from Benghazi over to Tobruk, going through the city of Darna, this is an area with one of the highest densities of Islamic terrorism anywhere in the world. If you're looking for jihadis, if you're looking for mujahideen, this seems to be the world capital, especially according to the U.S. government definition of terrorism. What happened was the U.S. forces back in 2007 captured the al-Qaeda personnel files in an area in Iraq near the Syrian border. And what they found was, in terms of terrorists per capita, Libya was by far the most active center for the recruitment of jihadis to go into Iraq and kill the U.S. and the NATO forces. Saudi Arabia sent more individual fighters, but in terms of population, Libya was the champion, but not all of Libya, especially this area of Benghazi and above all the city of Darna. Darna is a town of about 50 or 70,000 people, and they were the absolute world champion, number one in the world, in terms of sending terrorists into Iraq. And they were doing this, they beat Riyadh, the capital of Saudi Arabia, even though Riyadh is a city of 4 or 5 million people, and Darna is much smaller, again, 50 to 60,000 people by some estimates. It's so intense that in the city of Darna, you've got about 1,000 population. So that's enough to send one terrorist fighter. So one terrorist per 1,000 or 1,500 population at the most. And this is not simply a study that indicates the sociological tendency towards al-Qaeda terrorism, because that's who this was. We have it now confirmed. If you look at the London Daily Telegraph this past Saturday, based on a report in Il Sole 24 Ore, the main business newspaper in Italy, they sent their correspondent to Darna and interviewed the commandant of the city, the rebel commander. And he's a guy called Hasidi. And he says, yes, I sent 25 fighters to go and kill the US and NATO forces in Afghanistan. And he says he was there himself. He was captured near Peshawar. He may well have been an inmate of the Guantanamo Bay concentration camp. That part's not clear. But he is a former US POW, captured as a terrorist. And he is now commanding this amazing city of Darna, where you've got one terrorist fighter for every 1,000 or 1,500 of population. And this is the group that the U.S. regime, with Obama and Hillary Clinton and Cameron in Britain, are proposing to arm. They want to give them modern weapons. They want to give them a share of the $32 billion of Libyan assets that have been confiscated here. And they want them to have a share in the oil revenue. This is an absolute recipe for disaster. It's an exercise in insanity. And as you say, it shows they've learned absolutely nothing from the sad story of Afghanistan.
All right, Webster, taking absolutely everything you say there, what are your thoughts about what's going on the ground tonight? The opposition now, it seems, last 24 hours, has become somewhat helpless. Even the Allied support doesn't help them to hold on to those positions. They made so many gains, we all heard about in the last 48 hours before that. What's gone wrong? What's happening?
Well, the forces that are deployed by the CIA, because there's no other way to put it, are a very heterogeneous secret army, if you like. I see four components. One is you've got a tribal component, mainly delivered by the British. These are the Harabi and the Obeidat tribes. These are monarchists. They're not interested in democracy. These are the nostalgics for King Idris, the king who was installed by the British back in the 50s that Gaddafi overthrew. This is the majority of the rebel council. The CIA delivers two components. One is Al-Qaeda, the CIA secret army, the CIA Arab Legion, and there's also something called the Libyan Salvation Front here in Northern Virginia, a group of politicians and others who have been kept on the U.S. payroll. The French, the DGSE, Direction Générale des Services Extérieurs, deliver a group of generals around a guy called Mesmari, who was successfully turned, made to defect by the French. So those four components, two CIA, one British, one French, that creates this secret army. The U.S. is now so weak and so decrepit, if you will, we can't afford ground forces. We can afford air power and some naval power, but ground forces are too expensive.
So who's really in control of Libya's destiny? I mean, nearly 40 countries were deciding Libya's future in London on Tuesday. No one from Libya itself, from either side, was invited to that. So who is really in control of Libya's destiny?
Well, Libya right now is on its way to being divided into two parts, as Sudan has been, as Serbia has been, as Yemen is being divided. But the idea is that the Al-Qaeda forces are, in a sense, the U.S. land army against Gaddafi. Now, Gaddafi is somebody who has been around for quite a while. He is a very autonomous, a very ornery kind of fiercely independent guy. He began kicking out the Western oil companies last autumn, and he has been bringing in, for example, Russian investments. He's talked about bringing in the Russian railways to build a coastal railway, and he was trying to get some effective anti-aircraft missiles in his talks with Prime Minister Putin a little while ago, something that would have stood him in good stead right now. Right now, it's going nowhere except towards chaos. If the U.S. Air cover were withdrawn, Gaddafi would then reassert control over the country. If, however, that rebel army manages to get into the western areas, they will carry out a tribal vendetta, a massacre, a genocide, under the cover of an anti-genocide or pro-human rights, pro-civilians resolution from the United Nations. They're talking about arming those rebels, and the first thing those rebels will do is to go to Tripoli and conduct one of the greatest massacres of our time, and this has to be stopped.
Time. There's one thing I want to ask you. I want you to look into your crystal ball. Where do you think this is going to go? Where are we going to be in a month's time? Will Gaddafi still be there holding on?
I think Gaddafi has shown great resourcefulness. I think it's likely that the inherent contradictions in the imperialist coalition will come to the fore. The Italians in particular are very unhappy because one of the goals of this entire thing is to push the Italians out of Libya and replace them with the French. And we've got Sarkozy seems to think he's Napoleon. He's really more like Napoleon III at this point. So it seems to me that this is going to fragment. You've also got the British-French Suez 1956 coalition coming in. Right now here in the United States, this question of is it an Al-Qaeda force that you're supporting seems to be bubbling up towards the surface. That could be taken up, for example, by investigating committees in the House of Representatives or on cable television elsewhere that will make it politically very difficult to go down this road, especially the arming. Of course, they're already arming the rebels from Egypt, right? The CIA is sending in weapons.
Tarpley's predictions were shared by a number of analysts, political officials, and others who, although featured on RT, Press TV, and other international media, were never approached by any mainstream U.S. media outlets. 5 years later, it appears that military forces from the U.S., U.K., and France are again on the ground in Libya. That, according to the French newspaper Le Monde, as RT's Anna Baranova reports.
The article published in Le Monde this Wednesday morning is titled France Carries Out Secret Operations in Libya. And it's a big deal for the French because when the President François Hollande, following the attacks in Paris in the end of last year, had said that France was at state of war with ISIS, everyone thought it was more about security checkups in the subway. It was more about the military parading on Paris's streets. No one really thought that there would be action somewhere on the ground, while this article in Le Monde says that that's exactly what's going on. They're saying that perhaps the strike that killed a senior official of ISIS, Abu Nabil, that happened in November 2015, was carried out by French intelligence. They're saying that it was Hollande's decision to implement the French intelligence, the DGSE, together with the French elite armed forces on ground in Libya to fight the war with ISIS there. For instance, they quote a general staff of the French Navy by saying that we're preparing scenarios on hard sea. Now, it has to be said that the Defense Ministry, they decline any comment on the substance of this article that was published in Le Monde, and perhaps they might be also launching their own investigation into why this information has even surfaced.
At the outset of the attack on Libya, Muammar Gaddafi told the BBC and Christine Amanpour what to expect from the new partners the U.S., U.K., and France had gotten into bed with.
For a while now, the world has been hearing about the presence of Al-Qaeda in the Muslim Maghreb. We never thought that Al-Qaeda will come to Libya one day. Suddenly, over the past few days, they took advantage of what had happened in Egypt and Tunisia, and they made their presence felt here. We live in a safe country. Our camps and centers are open to the public. But Al-Qaeda members took advantage of this relaxed atmosphere and safety. And a group of youngsters launched attacks against police stations and military barracks. In Al-Baida and Benghazi. They stole weapons and started killing policemen and soldiers.
So, Mr. Gaddafi, you're saying then that they're motivated by extreme jihadist fervor, these demonstrators, Al-Qaeda people. I have to say the ones that I've met haven't been like that.
Yes, I understand what you're saying. I'm just explaining to you what had happened. These people have been drugged. They are on hallucinogenic drugs. The soldiers were trying to defend themselves. The other side killed fewer people than the terrorists did. But orders were then given not to open fire, and positions should be evacuated so that not to come under more attacks. These people captured the positions that we had evacuated. They attacked ammunition depots, and they took to the streets. They used mosques as headquarters and set up emirates under Al-Qaeda control.
The last of the Angola prisoners has been released. Political prisoner Mumia Abu Jamal offered this commentary.
Albert Woodfox, the last of the Angola Free, walked free. Albert Woodfox has a dubious distinction of having spent 43 years in the hole, solitary confinement, in the infamous prison farm and former slave plantation known as Angola, Louisiana. 43 years in a 6-by-9-foot prison cell, 23 hours a day. Oh, that extra hour in a concrete yard in shackles. Since the men known as the Angola Three, Robert King, Herman Hook Wallace, and Albert Woodfox, were convicted of the 1972 murder of a prison guard, the men were sentenced to a special kind of hell for decades. And this despite their innocence. King had his conviction overturned several years ago. Wallace was released in 2013 and died 2 days later of liver cancer. Woodfox, the last man standing, spent 43 years in the hole, perhaps the longest held solitary prisoner in the U.S. and perhaps in the world. All three men were innocent of murder, but guilty of black resistance. Prison officials found them guilty of what they called, I kid you not, black pantherism, and consigned them to the hole for decades. The men did the unthinkable, yes. They formed a chapter of the Black Panther Party in Angola prison. Last November, a federal appellate judge from the Fifth Circuit said of Woodfox, for the vast majority of his life, Woodfox has spent nearly every waking hour in a cramped cell in crushing solitude without a valid conviction. Judge James Dennis. Woodfox, after a no contest plea, goes free after a lifetime in hell.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.